To make a donation, visit biblicallycorrectpodcast.org/donate. And if you enjoyed this episode, please like, share, and subscribe. Thank you for your support. What Yeshua did so that we could do this with God. Welcome to the Biblically Correct Podcast. Shalom, y'all. This is the Biblically Correct Podcast, teaching biblical correctness in a biblically incorrect world. My name is Kevin Jeffrey. I'm a Jewish follower of the Messiah Yeshua, Jesus, and I love teaching the scriptures. There's a very good reason why the author of Hebrews went to such great lengths, taking multiple chapters to demonstrate and establish the total supremacy of Yeshua's priesthood. And now, having finished making his case for this in the middle of chapter 10, the author is finally ready to tell us why such a unique priesthood even matters. Because the purpose of his dissertation far exceeds our simply being told the theological or technical mechanism of our salvation. As we finish chapter 10 in today's episode, in our continuing series on the book of Hebrews, we'll find the author rounding the corner toward the whole purpose for his exhortative and urgent letter. So let's begin with a quick recap of the last few chapters so that we'll have the foundational understanding necessary for grasping the full weight of the author's message. So the sacrificial system established by Moses in the Torah was the God-ordained means of bringing forgiveness and atonement to the people of Israel. God commanded Israel to construct a tent for meeting with him and selected one tribe, Levi, to serve him as mediators and priests for the people. And this was all set up according to the pattern of things already established in heaven. But because of the fault of the priests of Israel, men with weakness, themselves susceptible to death, and in need of atonement for their own sins, the effect of their work and of their sacrifices made on behalf of the people was only temporary. This inadequacy required them to make sacrifices repeatedly, day after day, year after year, unable to make the people perfect by taking away their sins. It was therefore because of this deficiency that Israel needed another Kohen to arise, a second priesthood, not of the order of Levi, but an eternal priestly order, a priesthood with a better hope, guaranteeing a better covenant, sanctioned by Torah on better promises, with a better and perfectly effective sacrifice. And this is why God raised up his son, Yeshua, as high priest of that heavenly order, not constrained by sin and death, but unlimited, powered by a sinless, permanent, and indestructible life, one who could enter into heaven's greater and more perfect tent through his own blood just a single time, permanently taking away the sins and making us perfect so that God could remember our sins no more. It's therefore with this imagery of a perfected, sinless, and eternal priesthood, freshly and firmly established in his readers' minds, that the author now has what he needs to launch into his full exhortation of his Messianic Jewish brothers toward the full assurance of their faith. Picking up now in Hebrews chapter 10, verses 19 through 22, he says, "Therefore, brothers, having boldness for approaching the entrance into the holy places by the blood of Yeshua, we have a way which he initiated for us, new and living, through the curtain, that is his flesh, and a Kohen Gadol over the house of God. Let us draw near with a true heart, in full assurance of faith, having the hearts sprinkled from an evil conscience, and having the body bathed with pure water." Once again evoking the comparison to the earthly Mishkan in verse 19, the author makes his case. "Therefore," he says, since, as he says in the previous verse, where forgiveness of sin is, there is no longer any sacrifice for it, "therefore we can have boldness for approaching the entrance into the true holy places. We who are not priests, we who do not have permission from the Torah to enter earthly holy places, can now boldly enter into the presence of God." How? By the blood of Yeshua. By Yeshua's sacrifice, by the shedding of his sinless blood, according to verse 20, we have a new and living way to God. which he initiated through the curtain of his flesh. The way to God is no longer at arm's length, separated by earthly intermediaries, and attempted to be purchased by the blood of endless animal death. It has now been paid for once by the blood of Yeshua, whose sacrifice we may now pass through to enter boldly before God. Because through this new and living way, verse 21, we also have a high priest over the house of God, who mediates a new and better covenant of a true and heavenly tent of meeting. Therefore, let us draw near with a true heart, the author says in verse 22, in full assurance of faith, having no doubt that our great high priest has accomplished all that needs to be done for our perfection. Let us come before him to have our hearts sprinkled by his blood, removing from us our evil conscience, our conscience burdened by the guilt and defilement of sin, and to have our body bathed with the pure, clean water of forgiveness. So with the case now made for Yeshua's priesthood, and having established this confidence in and assurance of our salvation, the author begins to make a major topical shift, now turning to practical application. How can we put this certainty into action? And he begins to offer up guidance on how we can hold on to this faith so that we can persevere in it and not fall away, as he warned us about in previous chapters. In verses 23 through 25, then, he exhorts us this way. May we hold fast to the unwavering profession of the hope, for he who promised is faithful. And let us consider how to provoke one another to love and to good actions, not forsaking the gathering of ourselves together, as is the custom of certain people, but exhorting one another, and so much the more as you see the day coming near. So in verse 23, the author begins with an encouragement, telling us to hold fast to an unwavering profession of hope in Yeshua. He wants us to firmly grasp and take hold of that hope, and for that hope itself to be unwavering, for us to have an unshakable confidence in Yeshua because God is faithful to his promises. Then in verse 24, the author tells us about something that we should all do that will help us to hold fast to that hope. He says, let us consider how to provoke one another to love and to good actions. The author is telling us that our faith and hope are weakened when we're not being challenged in them and motivated toward them by other believers. And the mode that he's telling us to operate in for this isn't by preaching or teaching or praise and worship services or any other religious activity, but by provoking. He wants us to not let each other passively sit around, lazily resting on our blessed assurance. Instead, he's telling us to poke and prod one another as needed in order to move us to act in love and good. I notice that he doesn't say, consider how your pastor or rabbi or some guy on the internet can provoke you to love and to good actions by talking at you for 45 minutes. But he says, consider how to provoke one another. We won't be prepared to persevere in Yeshua because we receive passively from professional clergy. We'll be prepared to hold fast to the unwavering profession of the hope when we as peers, as fellow Messiah followers, take that hope seriously enough to be actively involved in each other's lives. This is what the author of Hebrews is urging us toward. Yet in order for such provoking of one another to happen, this presupposes that we actually have real, meaningful contact with other believers, that we're not walking alone. And that contact needs to be in an environment in which such provocation can take place. Therefore, we're supposed to consider how to provoke one another to love and to good actions, and verse 25, not forsake the gathering of ourselves together, as is the custom of certain people. Now, despite the common anachronistic interpretation of don't forsake the gathering to mean you have to go to church, which I discuss at length in episode 56 in my series about the purpose of the church, What the author's actually calling for here is something that's far too uncommon in today's body of Messiah, which explains the current shape we're in. He's not telling us to not forsake being fed the word from a pulpit or to not forsake group worship through singing and what have you. Whether those things are of any value or not simply isn't addressed by this verse. What he is telling us to not forsake is the gathering together of ourselves for the sake of provoking one another to love and to good actions. And it's no wonder that, as the author says, it's the custom of certain people to avoid such gatherings. Being on the receiving end of provoking, challenging, or exhortation isn't particularly easy. But that's exactly why the author's telling us to not forsake the gathering. Not so we can sit in rows staring at the back of each other's heads, listening to one guy talk at us, but to face one another as fellow believers in order to exhort one another, to provoke one another, to act upon our hope and faith. And again, as we saw in previous chapters, the author says this with a sense of urgency. He wants us to not forsake the gathering of ourselves together so that we can provoke and exhort one another to love and to good actions, so that we will hold fast to and persevere in our hope in Yeshua, and to do it so much the more as we see the day of Adonai, the day of judgment, coming near. It's easy to lose hope. It's easy to lose faith, especially as we wait for a coming of Messiah that still hasn't come. So the author's telling us to pull together in our push toward the hope of the promise, so that we won't let go and fall away and endanger ourselves by sliding back into the sin from which we've been saved. And this is exactly what the author's warning us about as he continues this train of thought in verses 26 through 31. The author admonishes us, "For if we keep willfully sinning after the receiving of the full knowledge of the truth, then there no longer remains a sacrifice for sins, but a certain kind of fearful expectation of judgment and fiery zeal about to devour the opposers. Anyone who has made a Torah of Moshe as nothing dies apart from compassion by the testimony of two or three witnesses. Of how much sorer punishment, then, will he be counted worthy, he who trampled on the Son of God and counted as a common thing the blood of the covenant in which he was set apart, and brought insult to the Ruach of the unmerited favor? For we have known him who is saying, 'Vengeance is mine, I will repay,' and again, 'Adonai will judge his people.' A fearful thing is the falling into the hands of a living God." So here the author of Hebrews is giving us his final word in its strongest terms about a hard truth for believers in Messiah, one that he's been weaving throughout his letter and is arguably the entire reason for his letter and sense of urgency. As I previously summed up in episode 84 on Hebrews chapter 6, these are true believers in Yeshua he's talking to. These are people who, according to chapter 6, verses 4 and 5, have been enlightened, having tasted also of the heavenly gift, and having become sharers of the Ruach HaKodesh, and tasted the good saying of God, also the powers of the coming age. There's no way that this is a description of a false convert. So he's definitely speaking to believers here. And it's these believers who the author's warning in chapter 3, verse 12, against having an evil heart of unbelief, resulting in the falling away from the living God. In chapter 3, verse 14, he exhorts us to hold fast to our faith until the end, because as he says in verse 19 and 4:1, unbelief within us should cause us to fear. In chapter 4, verse 11, the author admonished us to be diligent to enter into our eternal stopping place. And in chapter 5, verse 14, he wants us to have our senses trained to the discernment of both good and evil. Then, again in chapter 6, beginning in verse 4, he says, "For it is impossible for those once enlightened and having fallen away to be renewed again to reformation, having again crucified the Son of God to themselves and exposed him to public shame. And this concept leads directly to what we see here in verse 26. For if we keep willfully sinning after the receiving of the full knowledge of the truth, then there no longer remains a sacrifice for sins. Now, I went into detail on all this in episode 84, where I also dealt with the topic of once saved, always saved. So I won't get into it again here. I encourage you to watch that episode as well. But suffice it to say, all this, again, is a grave warning not to false converts, but for real, actual believers. He's been warning us ever since chapter 3 to not fall away from the living God. And look at how he set it up to return to this topic again here in chapter 10. He's just finished telling us about the awesome, eternally powerful, one-time sacrifice for sins that Yeshua has made for us. He's purified us. He's made us perfect. He set us apart and made us holy so that we may enter forever into God's presence through the curtain of his flesh. But if we keep willfully sinning after receiving all this, after receiving the full knowledge of that truth, then the author says that that sacrifice for sins no longer remains. No one's taking that salvation from you. You're not losing it because you've stumbled or misplaced it. You're deliberately throwing it away by your continued willful sin. Just as the Torah prescribed sin offerings for sins committed in ignorance, once a person learned that it was sin, but then willfully committed it again, it became a sin of defiance. And the Torah has no remedy for that. Instead, it says that that person must be cut off from his people. This is what the author of Hebrews is warning us about. Because if we do fail to persevere, because we've not gathered together and walked with our fellow believers who could have provoked and encouraged us to love and to good actions, and if we do manage to fall away, then the author tells us exactly what we can expect for ourselves at the day of Adonai. Verse 27, a certain kind of fearful expectation of judgment and fiery zeal about to devour the opposers. In this event, not only does Yeshua's sacrifice for sins no longer remain for us, but if we keep willfully sinning so as to fall away from the living God, then we become opposers of that sacrifice, for whom it is impossible to be renewed a second time to reformation, and for whom only fear and judgment and fiery zeal await. And to drive home his point, the author reminds his Messianic Jewish readers in verse 28 about the penalty for making the Torah as nothing, probably a reference to Deuteronomy 17 concerning those who sidestep the covenant and go after other gods. And he says that those who make the Torah as nothing die apart from its compassion by the testimony of two or three witnesses. So if this is the punishment for Israel disgracing the covenant of Torah, then verse 29, of how much sorer punishment then will he be counted worthy, he who trampled on the Son of God and counted as a common thing the blood of the new covenant. The one who makes the covenant of Torah as nothing dies without compassion, while the one who makes the new covenant as nothing by continued willful sin brings insult to the ruach of unmerited favor and heaps upon himself God's judgment, fiery zeal, and destruction. And the author backs this up in verse 30 by citing Deuteronomy 32, 35 through 36. For we have known him who is saying, vengeance is mine, I will repay. And again, Adonai will judge his people. When Messiah followers reject the blood of the new covenant through their continual willful sin, then this brings God's judgment and vengeance down upon them, his people. This is what the author of Hebrews wants us to be deathly afraid of, and why he wants us to provoke and exhort one another, and to draw near to God with a true heart in full assurance of our faith. Because as he says in verse 31, a fearful thing is the falling into the hands of a living God. So now, having completely scared his readers straight, in the final section of chapter 10, the author continues this word of exhortation, but true to form, builds us back up with words of encouragement and comfort. He begins by reminding his readers of the many things they've already endured and suffered for the sake of Messiah. In verses 32 through 39, he says, "And call to your remembrance the former days, in which, having been enlightened, you endured much conflict of sufferings, partly both with disgraces and oppressions, you being made objects of ridicule, and partly having become sharers of those so living. For you also sympathized with prisoners, and the robbery of your property you received with joy, knowing that you yourselves have a better possession, an enduring one. You must not throw away, then, your boldness, which has great payment of reward. For you have need of perseverance, so that you, having done the will of God, will receive the promise. For in yet a very little while, he who is coming will come, and will not delay. And my righteous one will live by faith, and if he draws back, my soul has no pleasure in him. But we are not of those who are drawing back to destruction, but of those believing to a preserving of the soul." So in verse 32, the author reminds his readers of the former days, a time at some point in the past after which they had been enlightened with the light of Yeshua and in his name endured much conflict and suffering. He reminds them in verse 33 how some of that suffering was in enduring oppression, being disgraced, and becoming objects of ridicule, while other parts of it involved sharing in the oppression and disgrace of other believers who were themselves enduring it. He brings to their remembrance in verse 34 how they sympathized with prisoners and were joyful despite suffering the theft of their own property, knowing that a better and enduring possession awaits them. So in light of these experiences, the author exhorts his readers in verse 35 to not throw away the boldness that they've already exhibited, to not lose faith now, because that boldness has a great payment of reward with Yeshua. They need to persevere in their hope and faith, he tells them in verse 36, so that having done the will of God, they will enter God's everlasting stopping place and finally receive the promise. Then the author encourages them once again, as he did previously in chapter 9, with the hope of Yeshua's soon return. He says in verse 37, "In yet a very little while, he who is coming will come and will not delay." And in verse 38, he cites the prophet Habakkuk, "My righteous one will live by faith." So yes, Yeshua is coming soon. But even when it's hardly soon enough for us, we must still live righteously by the certainty of our faith in it, no matter how long we have to wait. Because should we begin to doubt and not hold fast to that hope, the author reminds his readers that Habakkuk also says, "If he draws back, my soul has no pleasure in him." In other words, our impatience for Yeshua's return is no excuse to draw back from him and stop living in righteousness. Having faith in Yeshua and then withdrawing it is, to put it mildly, displeasurable to God. Yet the author wants us to be assured in verse 39 that we are not of those who are drawing back to destruction, but of those believing to a preserving of the soul. He's given substantial warning of the grave consequences they face for drawing back, but he's encouraging them, based on their own past experiences in Yeshua, that they have the strength of character and spiritual fortitude to persevere until the end. And it's the seedbed of these experiences that the author will now abundantly water with an accounting of Israel's faithful ones, which is what we'll be looking at in the next episode when we begin chapter 11. Verses 19 through 39 of Hebrews chapter 10 flow out of the author's chapters-long discussion about the superiority and perfection of Yeshua's sacrifice and priesthood. The thorough case he makes for Yeshua comes to the conclusion that through the sinless blood of the Messiah, we who believe in him no longer stand at arm's length from God, separated from him by earthly intermediaries, or with our sins only temporarily covered. The reason why Yeshua's priesthood matters is because it could do what the first priesthood could not. Only by Yeshua's unique mediation of a new covenant, being unconstrained by death, offering his own innocent blood, could a new and living way to God be initiated for us. With our sins fully paid for by the blood of Yeshua, not over and over again ineffectually, but perfectly one single time, we can now boldly enter into the salvation and presence of God, totally purified and completely unhindered. And yet, the author also has a grave warning for us, should we instead choose to keep willfully sinning, that Yeshua's sacrifice for sins will no longer remain for us, and we will face the judgment of the living God. So in order to preserve and persevere in our faith, the author exhorts us toward an important practice, to provoke one another to love and good actions, and to not forsake the gathering of ourselves together, not to gather in order to uphold passive religious observances, but so that we may actively hold each other accountable and help each other to not fall away. Through the blood of Messiah, our evil conscience of guilt has been washed clean, so that our profession of hope in him may be made without wavering. Let us draw near to God with a true heart, in full assurance of our faith, having no doubt that our great high priest Yeshua has once and for all accomplished our eternal perfection. Thanks for joining me for this episode of the Biblically Correct Podcast. If you like this episode and want to see us make more, then we need your help. Visit our website at biblicallycorrectpodcast.org to support the work of Perfect Word Ministries and MJMI through your much-needed donations. And of course, don't forget to rate, review, share, follow, or subscribe to the podcast to receive notifications whenever a new episode is posted. If you have any questions about this teaching, or if there are any other topics you'd like to see me cover, shoot me an email at kevin@perfectword.org. That's kevin@perfectword.org. Until next time, remember that every scripture is God-breathed and profitable for teaching, for refuting, for setting aright, and for instruction that is in righteousness, so that the man of God may be fully equipped, having been completed for every good act. Shalom.